In the Ring with Eusebius Makaiser. Eusebius Makaiser.
Welcome to another edition of In the Ring with me, Eusebius Makaiser. And I am in conversation with Vashna Jagannath in this series on the lifetimes and work of the brilliant American writer and so much more than that, James Baldwin. I hope all of you by now have had a chance to listen to the first in the series. We decided to devote August, just for no reason, because we can, to a couple of podcast episodes about him. And the first was episode 113. If you missed it, you can go and have a listen to it. You don't need to listen to them in the order in which we are recording them. So stay with this conversation and then go back and have a listen to episode 113 if you had missed out on it. What we wanted to do in this discussion is to really discuss him as an essayist. Because remember, this is a genius that has many performances in the spoken form and in the written form, being a playwright, a novelist, an essayist. And so you can celebrate and understand his entire range across different genres of writing. And as I noted in that episode 113, Notes of a Native Son, his essay collection, is one of those essay collections that made many of us really committed to the idea of the essay as a form through which to deliver very important commentary and observation about society. For me, it's different to a regular newspaper column, which is usually currently in the South African context anyway, anything between 600 and 800 words roughly. And an essay is long form writing. It gives you the space to unravel stories and arguments with a greater level of depth, nuance, and also aesthetic skill than you can in the very short form. It takes, in some ways, I guess, even greater skill to be able to deliver both aesthetic excellence and argumentation in 750 words. And I think very few people in the world are able to do that. But the essay, in my opinion, is underrated because we often think that the single topic manuscript is somehow a greater intellectual achievement. And for me, Notes of a Native Son is an excellent exposition, both the title essay, but also the entire collection of essay writing as a very serious, very particular form of writing. Vashna, welcome back to the platform. Wonderful to be in conversation with you.
Thank you, Eusebius, for having me.
Before we get into Notes of a Native Son, which is what I've picked, and then you'll talk about what you've picked, maybe just engage with my opening comments there. I've always been very precious and defensive about the essay because I've often felt in South Africa, certainly since I've been a professional writer over the last 10 to 15 years, that essays are sort of respected by some people who understand the technical differences between an essay, a newspaper column, and a manuscript. But it's very rare for essay collections to be given their due because essays are sometimes, I think, underappreciated. And that's why Baldwin, the essayist, to me, is so important.
No, absolutely. I could not agree more with you. I mean, what Baldwin is doing with the essay, and like you said, it's much more difficult to capture the nuance and the complexities of life in a shorter form than in a long form. In a long form, you have a lot of space to have evidence, to have footnotes, to have all of these things that people somehow assume that the wider or the larger time you expound on the topic, the more profound your idea is about it. And that's really just not true. I mean, I think that, you know, the ways in which Baldwin is able to, in a very short space of time, deliver incredibly important analysis of society, of writing, of culture, of economics, of race, of gender, is just absolutely astounding. And I also think that, you know, Eusebius, we tend to think that the essay is not appreciated. But I think popularly the essay is appreciated because it is in various ways a more accessible form of writing. It is in various ways allows people to dip in and out. I mean, trying to get through a 900-page book on, I don't know, Mahatma Gandhi, which I've had to do in my life, for example, means I have to go through that whole thing very carefully. Whereas if I want to dip in and out, I can. And the other important thing I just want to say very quickly about this Notes on a Native Son is what Baldwin is doing is he's also innovating around the nature and form of the biography and the autobiography, because he states very clearly that someone said to him, his friend, why doesn't he write a biography of himself? And he just thought he was too young to do so. But in a way, these essays are like sort of insights into his life, and I don't think they're any less richer because they're not giving us a chronological order of his life. And I think that is something so innovative, and it's often in radical Black thought that you find innovation like this happening.
I think that's spot on, beautifully put, both about the praxis and politics of radical Black thought, but also then particularly the creativity disrupting what you were taught in school are the only ways in which to write, including not being allowed to riff off several topics, which brings me to Notes of a Native Son. It starts off very famously, of course, with the death and the funeral service of his father and a description of his dad and his relationship with him. And the very first sentence, for those of us who are Baldwin addicts, is a very simple declaration. And of course, we clutch onto it, sometimes with pseudo profundity, when he was just being plain. On the 29th of July in 1943, my father died. On the same day, a few hours later, his last child was born. And the essay really genuinely is, as Vashna says, notes on a range of topics, but they are collectively a series of notes and observations about American society. And I wanted to take one part out of Notes of a Native Son, which is when he is in New Jersey and he's with a white friend from New York. And something happens when he goes to a big town called Trenton that I think is really interesting. And I want you to have a listen to this reading, which is an excerpt from Notes of a Native Son.
My last night in New Jersey, a white friend from New York took me to the nearest big town, Trenton, to go to the movies and have a few drinks. As it turned out, he also saved me from, at the very least, a violent whipping. Almost every detail of that night stands out very clearly in my memory. I even remember the name of the movie we saw because its title impressed me as being so partly ironical. It was a movie about the German occupation of France, starring Maureen O'Hara and Charles Laughton, and called This Land Is Mine. I remember the name of the diner we walked into when the movie ended. It was the American Diner. When we walked in, the counterman asked what we wanted, and I remember answering with the casual sharpness which had become my habit. We want a hamburger and a cup of coffee. What do you think we want? I do not know why, after a year of such rebuffs, I so completely failed to anticipate his answer, which was, of course, we don't serve Negroes here. This reply failed to decompose me, at least for the moment. I made some certain comment about the name of the diner, and we walked out into the streets. This was the time of what was called the brownout, when the lights in all American cities were very dim. When we re-entered the streets, something happened to me which had the force of an optical illusion or a nightmare. The streets were very crowded, and I was facing north. People were moving in every direction, but it seemed to me, in that instant, that all of the people I could see, and many more than that, were moving toward me, against me, and that everyone was white. I remember how their faces gleamed, and I felt, like a physical sensation, a click at the nape of my neck, as though some interior string connecting my head to my body had been cut. I began to walk. I had my friend call after me, but I ignored him. Heaven only knows what was going on in his mind, but he had the good sense not to touch me. I don't know what would have happened if he had, and to keep me in sight. I don't know what was going on in my mind, either. I certainly had no conscious plan. I wanted to do something to crush these white faces, which were crushing me. I walked for perhaps a block or two until I came to an enormous, glittering, and fashionable restaurant in which I knew not even the intercession of the Virgin would cause me to be served. I pushed through the doors and took the first vacant seat at a table for two and waited. I do not know how long I waited, and I rather wonder until today what I could possibly have looked like. Whatever I looked like, I frightened the waitress who shortly appeared, and the moment she appeared, all of my fury flowed toward her. I hated her for her white face and for her great, astounded, frightened eyes. I felt that if she found the black man so frightening, I would make her fright worthwhile. She did not ask me what I wanted, but repeated as though she had learned it somewhere, "We don't serve Negroes here." She did not say it with the bland, derisive hostility to which I had grown so accustomed, but rather with a note of apology in her voice and fear. This made me colder and more murderous than ever. I felt I had to do something with my hands. I wanted her to come close enough for me to get her neck between my hands. So I pretended not to have understood her, hoping to draw her closer, and she did step a very short step closer, with a pencil poised incongruously over her pad, and repeated the formula, "Don't serve Negroes here." Somehow, with the repetition of that phrase, which was already ringing in my head like a thousand bells of a nightmare, I realized that she would never come any closer and that I would have to strike from a distance. There was nothing on the table but an ordinary water mug, half full of water, and I picked this up and hurled it with all my strength at her. She ducked, and it missed her and shattered against the mirror behind the bar. And with that sound, my frozen blood abruptly thawed. I returned from wherever I had been. I saw, for the first time, the restaurant, the people with their mouths open, already, as it seemed to me, rising as one man, and I realized what I had done and where I was, and I was frightened. I rose and began running for the door. A round, pot-bellied man grabbed me by the nape of the neck just as I reached the doors and began to beat me about the face. I kicked him and got loose and I ran into the streets. My friend whispered, "Run." And I ran. My friend stayed outside the restaurant long enough to misdirect my pursuers and the police who arrived, he told me at once. I do not know what I said to him when he came to my room that night. I could not have said much. I felt in the oddest, most awful way that I had somehow betrayed him. I lived it over and over and over again, the way one relives an automobile accident after it has happened and one finds oneself alone and safe. I could not get over two facts, both equally difficult for the imagination to grasp, and one was that I could have been murdered. But the other was that I had been ready to commit murder. I saw nothing very clearly, but I did see this, that my life, my real life, was in danger, and not from anything other people might do, but from the hatred I carried in my own heart.
Vashna, that excerpt from Notes of a Native Son is absolutely incredible on so many levels. I don't even know where to start, so let's just be dynamic about it. I suppose to cut straight to the concluding couple of sentences that I read, one of the most violent, literally and figuratively, consequences and features of white supremacy and anti-Black racism, which is really the same thing and intertwined, is not only that whiteness strikes out at us structurally, and that some white people who are white supremacist individuals can be violent towards us. But when James Baldwin reflects on his own capacity to murder, it brings tears to my eyes, because as with patriarchal violence, it reminds us that part of the dehumanization of racism is that racism also shows us our capacity for violence as the victims and survivors of racism.
No, I mean, absolutely. It also demonstrates to us that, what we have been trying to do is, I mean, Baldwin talks about it, C.L.R. James talks about it, this way in which we are in this relationship within slavery when he's talking about the slaves in the plantations in the West Indies, that both get damaged by this toxic relationship of exploitation and the use of slavery in order to create the structural hierarchy within society. And then obviously those personalized violence acted out by white supremacists, but also by people who are willing to enforce that structure. Because
Yes.
yes, there's that immediate violence we experience when, he writes about his neck snapping, that, that depersonalization of racism, right? That we all experience when we actually someone is racist to us. But there's also the violence every day that's unseen that allows that system to continue. And it is shocking to us, and especially it was shocking to James because, in the Notes of Native Son, when he's writing about his father, he talks very movingly about how he didn't want to become this angry man like his father was. He didn't want to carry on with that same apocalyptic notion of the world. And that, I think, is something lots of black people don't want to do. We don't want to carry that generational trauma with us. We don't want to continue with that hatred. We want to think that we can make things and remake ourselves in this world, because not just because of some stupid liberal dream that's been told to us, but because we can think, because we can appreciate things, because we are like every other human being, full human beings, and want to live those full lives. But actually, we are not ever allowed to do that. And we are not allowed to do that because every generation until this structure of
Absolutely.
racism is not dealt with, every generation has this experience. And it might not be as severe and extreme as what Baldwin says about like thinking about murder, but it is there. And we do have some space in our heart, whether it is when we are mocking someone who's white, with our black friends jokingly so that we can get feels powerful in that moment. It's all sorts of things we are doing all the time to assert our own dignity against this violence that has been done to us. And unfortunately, many of us who don't want to be violent, who want to live fully in the world, are not given that opportunity. And that's who Baldwin was, and he was never given that opportunity.
I couldn't agree with you more, but I want to stay with that before I get to the next part of that excerpt that really grips me. There's something about that self-abnegation at the end of that passage when Baldwin almost confronts the man in the mirror and recognizes the chokehold that hatred that is morally justified as a response to white supremacy has on my humanity as a black person. And then I think, Vashna, of way too many individual white persons, many in positions of power, some who will listen to this clip and get annoyed right now in South Africa, who thinks that you or I wake up to perform anger and to somehow cash in on it as a kind of black economy of anger that, just in 2022 gives us political and economic cachet. None of us want to wake up and do that. You and I have a range of aesthetic interests. We would rather talk about, I don't know, the contingent history of the Nopkiri, the sexuality of Shaka, or about music, or about, I don't know, the contours of free speech or magic realism, for example. And when Baldwin recognizes the diminishing effect on black humanity that hatred does, it angers me because there are many white people who do not appreciate that that is constitutive of white supremacy and also simultaneously the consequence of white supremacy, as opposed to just the natural condition of being black.
Absolutely. I mean, so once we even look in the mirror and recognize that we are, like Baldwin does, being compromised in ourselves because we have to continuously do this labor and this labor and work of, rebelling against the system, of pushing up against it. We constantly have to do it. It's exhausting, it's tiring. It's something, you're right, we don't want to have to do. I wished we never had to do it, but it has to be done. And I think for me, the most important thing is that what we need to understand when Baldwin is talking about this is that, even today, The minute we raise an issue around this, the minute in 2022 the matter is raised, you are not only dealing with your own issue of having to raise it, you are also then rendered to be irrational. You are rendered to be less than. You are rendered to be too loud and out of place in a society like ours. And this is fundamentally the problem. So you then have to deal with the second layer
Absolutely.
Of people like you've mentioned.
Absolutely. There are two other features I want to pick up on, and then I'm going to give you the discursive burden of telling me which part of this essay collection you want to meditate on. But of the two remaining features of the excerpt that I read, one of them is a little bit as an echo with something that happened to you personally recently. And we don't have to rehearse all of that trauma for you, but an element of it. I found it really interesting in that excerpt that was read from Notes of a Native Son. Baldwin's friend is a white friend. At the second diner where they end up and Baldwin has to run away, his friend successfully lies to the people that are looking for him, including the police, about where he had run to, which gives him the space to be able to run to safety. Mm-hmm. And that jumped out at me because the epistemic authority, and for those who are not familiar with that kind of language, I'm using it deliberately because I want to expand our vocab and conceptual reach on this platform as Black people so that we know what white people are gossiping about when they use this kind of language. Epistemic authority refers to being believed and being respected as one who has knowledge and who's reliable as a producer of knowledge. And I thought to myself, how many Black witnesses or Black friends would have their words so easily taken at face value as Baldwin's white friend? The white ally in that moment not only cannot fully know what the Black condition and Black experience is like, even though both of them are both establishments. And so there's something there about the limitation, which is no fault of the white ally, but the necessary limitation of the white ally in terms of the deep personal subjective experience of racism on the part of the Black friend. But also, in addition to that, Vashna, is the casual reliability and reference to the white ally as a conveyor of fact and truth of what has gone on. And for me, it was a little bit like a white man being upset with both you and another white man, but mm-hmm. seeing the other white man, who happens to be your ex-husband, as being inside mm-hmm. the circle of reason. And to connect with the point you've just made, seeing you as a Black woman, as being beyond or outside of reason, an object of social analysis rather than an interlocutor.
Absolutely. I mean, my response was rendered irrational, and the white ex-husbands of my response was rendered very rational and something to be engaged with. And I think that that happens continuously, and that speaks to the deep structure of knowledge in our society. And you know, Edward Said always speaks about this. He says that those that control the production of knowledge control how people are represented within society, how we speak of it. And he says this is at the heart of the imperialist project, right? So it's at the heart of the imperialist project. It's at the heart of the capitalist project. We will produce the knowledge about you and we will engage you as an anthropological subject. But yes. You know, heaven forbid you yourself become an anthropologist and want to engage us about our habits and our ways of being and our flaws and our cultural, you know, sort of accoutrements, and, you know, coming to say, oh, wow, this is so exotic, roast turkey at Christmas. Wow, lovely. Thank you so much. I mean, you know, so those things can never happen because they are the norm. They are the producers of how the world is made. And it's not just an epistemological knowledge of epistemic knowledge of that moment. It's an epistemic knowledge of the entire world because the world is structured by them. They cannot see outside of that.
Absolutely.
And they cannot see themselves as acting outside of that because they can't see that there's a world outside of them. They themselves have bought into their own authority. And that is the problem.
100%. The last lamentation for me is James Baldwin's description that is so visceral when he looks at the white woman waiter at the second diner. And on the one hand, he gives her some humanity by recognizing that although she says Negroes are not served here, she clearly looks embarrassed as if she is mouthing what she's been taught and doing so against potentially a better judgment, but mechanically, nevertheless, doing so. But in the same vein, she becomes a representation of all white people for him, which is why he's got this violent impulse of wanting to strangle her, and she doesn't come close enough, so he ends up just throwing this tarfled mug at her, and she ducks just in time. And what strikes me about that particular moment, Bhashna, is, again, how our humanity is undercut as a consequence of white supremacy. Even though you and I, in different ways, because we've got important political differences, I am a liberal, you are not, but we're both deeply committed to structural analysis to understand society. So, of course, there's a sense in which the group, phenotypically white human beings in the history of anti-Black racism, have group benefits, and Becky, that is serving him, is part of that lineage. But I find it very melancholic that he's unable to see her as an individual and is responding to the mere fact of her whiteness, which triggers in him his experiences of white people in general in America. And for me, there's something really tragic about that, because although group analysis, structural analysis is important, and of course, despite what Abo Helen Ziller thinks, the idea that we are only individuals rather than also individuals within social structures is absolute bullshit. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, in that moment, he does exactly what many white supremacists do, which is mm-hmm. to see the individual Black person as a stand-in for all Black people. And in the mm-hmm. same way, the white waitress becomes a placeholder for the entire category of white people. I don't want to condemn him for that, but I think it's interesting as another example of the ways in which our own better judgments are undercut mm-hmm. because of our experiences of racism.
I think actually I have a bit more of a sympathetic reading to him, because I think actually what happens there in that moment to him is that he recognizes in her as an individual, and in white women in general, as a group of people who themselves have faced various levels of oppression in society and who themselves have to face patriarchy, who themselves have to have faced various sorts of economic constraints and have been, you know, inferior economically for generations and generations. So he identifies in her. I think the reason why it hurts more is that he's in identifying with her, he's assuming there'll be more sympathy coming from her. And when it is not forthcoming, the anger is so shocking, because the anger will be more shocking from an ally. Me, if someone hates me, and they always hate me, and I know they hate me, I'm not going to be surprised if like a Bruder Bond sort of guy comes up and he's racist to me, right? But I am surprised when the liberals, the white liberals who claim to be not racist, are racist and act in the most racist ways, right? Which actually I shouldn't technically be surprised, but it is surprising, because you are not expecting it from that. So I think for me, it's that shock of seeing. And if you think about the history of how racism and class has worked here and in the United States, because there's such similarities between our societies in this particular context around the question of race, is that you are often thinking that the white woman will be on your side. But as you know, when I wrote that piece around, you know, Sojourner Truth was they didn't want her to speak at the women's convention. And she assumed, when she wanted to speak, and when she did speak, she spoke for the rights of all people. Yet in that moment, there were women there who were facing oppression themselves, white women, who did not want someone who is even more oppressed than them to speak. That, I think, is where the sort of betrayal comes.
Yeah, that's an interesting reading, and it certainly makes very sense. We have discussed beautifully the layers from one excerpt of one essay. That is the gift of this man, and all he was doing was, and I say all in heavy quotes, was narrating an experience, a night out in New Jersey. And yet we have an entire essay collection I don't even know where to from here. What stood out for you that you wanted to dip into? Just unmute yourself, Vashta. Full permission to speak.
Sorry.
The epistemic authority is hereby recognized.
So I think for me, there's so much, you know, the stuff about Brown and Black meeting in Paris, his essays about not being in the United States are also incredibly interesting. Racism works in those ways, in those spaces, but not with the same violence that's meted out in the United States, for example, because we must remember, you know, we glossed over that beating that happened to him in the restaurant. He feared for his life, like most African Americans do every day of their lives in the United States. So it's a very real thing. But what really also spoke to me, and in terms of the theme of the essayist, is this Everybody's Protest novel.
Yeah.
So it is here that he's speaking about a novel that's written as a protest novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it's written by the allied white person, you know, to explain what's wrong with slavery. And that's the story. That's the heart of the story. And, you know, Baldwin says this is something we are never allowed to criticize. But through analyzing this book, he's able to make such a deep commentary around the role of the sort of liberal politics, the sort of politics of allies, but also around the rhetoric of the American dream. You know, this notion of American comes in all the time. This perfect America. It's the American diner. It's the American dream. It's the American novel, you know? And he keeps on picking away at that notion of Americanness, which he says America would like to create for us, this notion of apple pie, sitting at the lake, going to the beach, everyone's Mr. Joe, all this nice, lovely world, white picket fence. But that's just a false image that sits up and underneath sits all this ugliness and this hatred and this exploitation. And, you know, Malcolm X speaks about it when he says, you know, we don't live the American dream. We only experience the American nightmare. And that's exactly what Baldwin's constantly trying to tease out. And he does so through a novel that everyone will think should not ever be criticized. Because imagine at a time when there's slavery and racism, there's a white person who's been an ally. And he says, well, actually, this book has done a huge amount of damage to the ways in which we discourse upon racism and has had really very real consequences for us. He also just says, you know, it's an incredibly bad novel and not well written at all.
What are one or two examples of why it is a bad novel, or politically or morally insufficient in its description of slavery, contrary to the uncritical praise?
Okay, he says here, this is very important. He says, the protest novel, so far from being disturbing, is an accepted and comforting aspect of the American scene, ramifying that framework we believe to be necessary. Whatever unsettling questions are raised are evanescent, titillating, remote, for this has nothing to do with us. It is safely ensconced in the social arena, where indeed it has nothing to do with anyone. So that finally we receive a definite thrill of virtue from the fact that we are reading such a book at all. This report from the pit reassures us that its realities and its darknesses and of our own salvation. And as long as such books are being published, an American liberal once said to me, everything will be all right.
It reminds me a little bit of our discussion about the time immediately after emancipation, into which he was born, his parents. And one of the points that you had raised, or maybe that was, you know, our previous podcast rather about the Juneteenth celebrations, the point that you were making that there can be a legal end to a particular form of oppression, like 1994, legally ending apartheid, but in the base structure of society, and in the material conditions of the land and the individual experiences at a subjective level of those who are now nominally, legally declared to be free, you can have many unfreedoms And the problem with a novel that celebrates the end of slavery is it might not go far enough in describing and observing and paying attention to the remnants of slavery that continue for a very long time after that.
Yeah, and not only does it not do that, it refuses to undo the racialized tropes that actually allowed slavery to exist in the first place, and refuses to, and that also allows racism to continue, you know, because Uncle Tom is a sort of very, the sort of black man who's the scary black man, who's dark skinned, who's curly haired, who's illiterate.
Yeah.
And he has no control over himself. And yeah. Then that's set against the family of the of the Negroes, who are very sort of well put out together. They are, he calls them hybrid and light. So basically it's people who are mixed race, who are more acceptable to whiteness, who are educated, whose husband happens to be a master engineer. They happen to have become more white. So he says that in this novel, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin is not actually interested in undoing racism. Mm. What rather she is interested in doing is being an ally to tell black people the way out of this wretched condition, because your condition is wretched, because she accepts the worldview that blackness is a wretched condition to be in. Mm. She says that to get out of that wretched condition, you need to become more white. You need to, that's why, you know, you need to wear white clothes. You need to become white in your mannerisms. You need to be educated. You need to be brilliant. You need to have all of these things. And at the heart of that, it means that for blackness, for in order for blackness to be accepted, you have to defeat that is that which is what is black in you. And you have to become this thing which is what they see as white. And what whiteness is, it's excellence, it's intelligence, it's civilization, it's being polite, it's all of these things. And blackness is the antithesis of that. So there is no space for us as black people to actually be complex. You know, you can't be educated and evil, because then you're just not a full human. But you can certainly be a white person who is a highly educated scientist who creates nuclear weapons, which is evil, and still be respected.
Yeah, or murder your father, and then there's a Netflix documentary about you having done so.
Yes, there is no space for complexity. And they're trying to understand why you've done so, because that's an abnormality.
Yeah.
Something went wrong with you along the way. There was a glitch in your system of whiteness. So it's like this matrix of whiteness. And he says that is the fundamental flaw of this kind of system, is where you are accepting it. You are accepting this division within society, and you're okay with it. And all black people need to do is assimilate. And you know, Eusebius, this is such an important point, because I just want to go back to Notes of My Native Son. Sorry, I'm speaking so much.
But no. I don't want you to stop, because I was monopolizing time on our first part of the discussion. But I do want you to go back, because I was going to remind you where else you need to go, because this reminds me of our preparatory discussion for this recording, but something that we've spoken about before in the history of education, when we did a discussion of that on radio, that it is similar, and I'm just riffing while you're finding your place. It is similar to a point that you've made before, Vashna, that it connects with the civilizing mission of missionaries. This is also something Joanne Joseph pays attention to very beautifully with one of her characters in Children of Sugarcane, who is an ally, a white priest that is different to the other pigs on the sugarcane farms. But it's easy to think uncritically about a white ally. But many of them come to the Eastern Cape, for example, and set up schools that effectively want you to be miniature versions of children in England rather than to be children and human beings on your own African terms.
Exactly. And, you know, he says here in actually in the same essay, Everybody's Protest Novel, he says that this kind of protest novel becomes something very closely resembling the zeal of those alabaster missionaries to Africa to cover the nakedness of natives, to hurry them into the pallid arms of Jesus and thence into slavery. It's absolutely beautiful phrasing. But, you know, this is so important, because I think what he's speaking to is this lack of changing of structure, of accepting the norms of society that have been established through imperialism, capitalism, and racism, and patriarchy in our society, and not undoing that system. And, you know, Eusebius, I will end with a quote of his, but I just want to say this quickly. what in and in the notes on
Notes of a Native Son.
Native Son, he does also bring that up again about the
Yes.
ways in which this continues in our society from generation to generation. And in South Africa, we did the same thing. We didn't undo the system. We didn't, when we had a moment to undo it, we didn't. In fact, we're just sent along, and this we know is something you and I have discussed in great depth, is the issue that a lot of the people in the Fees Must Fall movement were raising, that their blackness was not affirmed, that they were not allowed to be who they were. Everything was discouraged, from their hair, from the food they brought to school. And this is in a black country where you are not allowed, because the hegemonic narrative is still whiteness. And we were meant to assimilate. We were meant to become part of that white world. Hence the Model C schools and all of that investment into that world.
100%.
And we were actually let down by that generation who should have been undoing it for us, but also giving us the tools to further undo it. We were left after 1994 to just fend for ourselves. And basically, the message that came to us from the popular world, from the cultural and social world, as well as the economic world, is that whiteness is the model. We may have had a black government, we may have had policy that was in our favor, but the structure of society didn't change. And what Baldwin says is this. He says, it must be remembered that the oppressed and the oppressor are bound together within the same society. They accept the same criteria, they share the same beliefs, they both alike depend on the same reality. Within this cage, it is romantic, more meaningless to speak of a new society as a desire of the oppressed. For that shivering dependence on the props of reality, which he shares with the Herren folk, makes a truly new society impossible to conceive. What is meant by a new society is one in which inequalities will disappear, in which vengeance will be exacted. Either there will be no oppressed at all, or the oppressed and the oppressor will change places. But finally, as it seems to me, what the rejected desire is an elevation of status accepted within the present community. And this is so important. It's a radical structural change. And he says the protest novel does not recognize this because the failure of the protest novels lie in its rejection of life, the human being, the denial of his beauty, dread, power. In this, in its instances, that is its categorization alone, which is real and which cannot be transcended. So it's he's saying deeply human in a way.
I think it's a beautiful note to end on, and I think it's really important. I want to be optimistic and say, once you have the insight, what are you going to do about it? And what are you going to plot as the way out of the current situation? I do
Exactly.
think, and that's a conversation for another day, that sometimes we are unkind to ourselves for not having been woker than we were in the early 90s. As guinea pigs shipped off to the town, to suburbs from the townships as the first generation of coconuts. And we didn't have the language and the tools. We were grateful that our parents, quote unquote, sacrificed working very hard at factories, low paid jobs to be able to pay those school fees. There was no space to think about the hair policy of the school, a school song that doesn't include us new arrivals, but harks on about what happened in the 19th century when the school was founded, when it was only for white people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now that we do have the tools, it doesn't have to be business as usual, which is why I shared with you, Vashna, that peace of mind that I wrote this morning, because I was in Makanda over the weekend and it's bad. I've said that before. I've written about the state of Makanda.
All the pictures as
But
well.
when you do that as a black or brown person and you bitch and moan, rightly so, about municipalities across the country, you always have that one supremacist who takes the opportunity to say, that's what happens when you focus on identity politics. That's what happens when you are race obsessed. That's what happens when we don't talk about what unites us in our fight against the ANC and we focus on what divides us. There's a version of that that's progressive, like the 56 March. And there's a version of that, which brings us back to everybody's protest novel, that is an attempt to not go far enough in liberal politics, and to avoid the critique about the total quest for intersectional justice and simply ending at the point where we chuck out the obviously bad people, like your AWB types, the residents of Orania, but we dare not speak about the white, liberal, English-speaking person's unconscious biases and privileges, let alone economic and other forms of injustice. And that, for me, is an optimistic note in the sense that, I mean, you've understood this stuff for a longer period than I have, but now that you know capitalism reinforces and is related to racism, and you can't talk about the one without the other, then the question is, what does your politics look like starting at the end of this recording, rather than lamenting not having known and understood this 10 years ago?
Absolutely. No, I agree with you. And also to understand that there is a template, that there is stuff out there. You don't have, it's, people aren't alone in understanding this. Mm. There's work that's been done. Baldwin has done the work. There's work that's been done in a variety of ways. Angela Davis, people from the Black Panther movement, Steve Biko did the work. The work has been done. We just need to access it. We need to broaden our minds. And I think platforms like this allow us to do that, because we need to get these things, because our state is certainly not doing it for whatever reason, and it could very easily do so. It's not required to make any revolutionary changes. Just include Baldwin in the curriculum. I mean, for God's sake, you know, something simple like that. It's like rocket science. And, you know, and everyone can see, I mean, you know, the liberals aren't even hiding anymore. Like John Steenhuisen, it's not like an unconscious thing. His sexism, his racism, his ugliness is all out there for the world to see.
Yeah,
it's absolutely brazen. We don't have to go far to look. We just need to have the courage to stand up to it. And it is exhausting and it's tiring. Yeah. But we have to do it if we want to make a new world.
Absolutely.
And that's what we have to do.
Okay, so we've given you a taste of two essays, Everybody's Protest Novel, and of course, the title essay, Notes of a Native Son. The entire collection is absolutely brilliant. The stuff that happens in Paris, including him being jailed, is hilarious, insightful. There's so many other essays we could have spoken about. We didn't have the time. Stranger in the Village, Equal in Paris, one of my favorites, A Question of Identity, The Harlem Ghetto. Please find a copy of Notes of a Native Son. Enjoy it. Enjoy his bitchiness, his pithy use of language to deliver deep insights with an economy of language usage that is just so instructive. And I don't know what we're going to do next. Vashna will decide. Yeah. I know if we can squeeze in two more, I want to talk fiction. I'll probably pick one of my favorite novels. But the next one, Vashna will decide how we're going to frame it. But I really hope that we've excited you about James Baldwin, the essayist, and that you will go and Google his essays and perhaps go to a secondhand bookstore and see whether you can lay your hands on a copy of Notes of a Native Son. Vashna, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I hope that your pots are not burning.
No, thank you.
Bye. Cheers.
Bye.